that Namibia, the problem we have, in Namibia is that we are not a knowledge-based society. So our participation in things will be very limited. And that's why even our desire for news, we want to hear negative news, who committed suicide where. We want to hear, you know, even the legal, we are fighting for the legalization of things that don't even come to benefit us economically. That's another sign. It's a very sad sign to show that is showing us that we are not knowledge driven. Maybe we are, but maybe the type of knowledge that we are interested in having is not the knowledge that will help us grow economically. It's a knowledge that in fact just make us busy in things that don't, you know, in non-issues. Therefore, today we want to get into a conversation because we are talking about skilled labor, we are talking about, you know, innovation and growth, economic growth, but we know that the labor force is very important. It plays a major role in the economic growth of any country. So we talk about the labor stress. And when we talk about labor stress, we don't only want to talk about employees only, but employers too. Because employers are the backbone of the, they are also contributing to the economy. Without them, there will be no employment. So you can't create jobs without having employers in mind. And we'll come and talk about it with a labor expert, that is Herbert Yauch, that is coming from around, you know, 1:30. And otherwise, we will be also joined by Dwight Links, who is just going to fill us in with what is happening. Namibia has, you know, celebrated World Ozone Layer, World Ozone Day. So that is the celebration. And when we talk about ozone layer, we also know that ozone layer also contributes to our industrial, you know, development. And now we are even talking about green. We are talking about green energy, green economy, and so forth. So, we are talking about green energy. And the ozone layer plays a very important role because of, you know, of climate change. So a lot of enablers, economic enablers that we have, the entire ecosystem is an economic enabler. All right, so we are going to listen to these presentations and then we'll see if Dwight can take us more into more details on what, you know, the celebration or the event was.
The World Ocean Day is observed every year on the 16th of September to commemorate the signing of the Montreal Protocol of 1987 and to spread awareness about the importance of the ozone layer and the preservation thereof. This year, we are gathered here to observe the World Ozone Day under the theme From Science to Global Action. The adoption and signing of the Montreal Protocol on 16 September 1987 marked a turning point in our fight against ozone depletion. This treaty is widely regarded as one of the most successful international environmental agreements, with the primary objective to eliminate ozone depleting chemicals such as CFC. As we gather to commemorate World Ozone Day, we reflect on a huge achievement in our collective history. In 1987, the Montreal Protocol was initially signed by 46 countries. Today, this treaty has since achieved universal ratification with 197 countries, ultimately signing and pledging to safeguard not just our health, but the very fabric of our planet. Ladies and gentlemen, Namibia is a dry and arid country, and almost severely affected by the climate crisis. We see climate change in alerting weather patterns, rising temperatures, drought, floods, and biodiversity loss. These impacts are not distinct scientific projections. What happens to Namibia matters beyond our borders. Because the climate crisis respects no boundaries, and our experience is a warning that what the world faces, we do not act with urgency. I am therefore pleased to inform you that Namibia is taking proactive steps to address the ozone layer depletion through support from various stakeholders for implementation of the Montreal Protocol. On 24 March 2025, the National Ozone Unit, under the Ministry of Industries, Mines and Energy, in collaboration with the Cooling Program for Southern Africa, donated tools and equipment worth 1,650,710 Namibian dollars and 33 cents to our four vocational training centers in Windhoek, Kobabas BTC, Balamola BTC, and NIMT. Today, I want to highlight a crucial element in our journey toward environmental sustainability, the pivotal role of industries. The success of Montreal Protocol stands as a powerful example of what can be achieved when governments, scientists, and industries collaborate.
All right, that is now the minister's speech, that climate change respects no one. The issue we have is that we are part of the global industrial revolution, and the chlorofluorocarbons that is being said as a result of our quest for economic growth. And that's why ozone celebration or ozone day is important. It's economic. It's an economical issue. Because of ozone layer issues that we are forced to transform into green energy systems. And those don't come cheap. They need, investment. But we will call before we maybe we will now we are now going to listen to more presentation on this issue, on this subject, before we call in our very colleague, that is Dwight Links, to just sum it up, as far as the ozone day is concerned.
The Montreal Protocol was adopted in 1987 and entered into force in 1989. And it's recognized as the most successful multilateral environmental agreement in history. Namibia became independent in 1990, and acceded to this agreement within a period of 3 years in 1993. This therefore meant that Namibia assumed international obligations to phase out ozone depleting substances, that's ODS, and to contribute to the global recovery of the stratospheric ozone layer. Today, we join the global community in commemorating the World Ozone Day, marked by international solidarity on the existence of the Montreal Protocol, which is close to 4 decades, as it was indicated, 40 years. This is the treaty aimed at protecting the planet from the ozone-depleting substances. This is indeed testimony that when the world acts in unison under multilateral frameworks with determination, positive changes are realized. Director of Ceremonies, the ozone layer serves as the Earth's protective shield, safeguarding life on planet by filtering out harmful ultraviolet radiation from the sun, without which human health, biodiversity, and the entire ecosystem would exist. Therefore, protecting the ozone layer is not only an environmental obligation, but it's a matter of our existence. It's a matter of life and death. Namibia notes with appreciation that scientific findings that the ozone layer is on the trajectory of recovery due to our collective global efforts to reduce and phase out the ozone-depleting substances. We have phased out nearly 99% of the ozone-depleting substances. This achievement shows that multilateralism does work indeed, and it gives us hope as we confront today's greatest challenge of climate change. The world recorded a great environmental leap when it amended the Montreal Protocol, most notably through the Kigali Amendment of 2016, which aims to phase down the production and consumption of hydrofluorocarbons, chemicals that do not damage the ozone layer but has the high global warming potential which causes climate change. The Kigali Amendment targets to avoid up to about 0.4 degrees Celsius of global warming by the end of the century, making it one of the greatest climate agreements in history. Director of Ceremonies, allow me to briefly highlight on the actions back at home here in Namibia. The Government of the Republic of Namibia, through the Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism, in collaboration with the Ministry of Industries, Mines and Energy, and industry partners, especially the refrigeration and air conditioning sector, are fully committed to fulfill our obligations under the Montreal.
Right, that's the ED, that's Executive Director in the Ministry of Environment, Forestry and Tourism. That is, of course, Sikongo Haihambo, talking about the issue of climate change. And, of course, before we bring in Dwight, we need to listen to the aircon industry, because, you know, it is hot now, and ventilation is very important, and it could be that part of which it's also contributing to the ozone layer. Nobody knows, but we can listen, and then from there we'll talk deeper on how much, you know, how economical is the ozone layer itself, or how much it influences our economic choices, and in fact industrial choices, because we need to deal away with, you know, ozone depleting substances. And is that cheap? Of course, maybe it is cheap to industrialized countries, but not cheap to countries like Namibia that is busy developing. But let's just take a listen and we'll return. We will meet the other side.
As a short remarks on the importance of refrigeration and air conditioning worldwide in our area. Honorable Deputy Ministers of Mines and Energy, distinguished government officials, esteemed representative from various industries, I would like just to point out a number of points for the importance of the air conditioning and refrigeration sector. Number one, it's not visible, but you can tell this is the importance of it. I will go in point by point. Number one, the invisibility and backbone of modern life. This is the importance of refrigeration and air conditioning. You start from home, you go to the hospital, you go to agriculture, fishery, whole chain, in businesses, in offices. We are talking of air conditioning and refrigeration, isn't it? These are the backbone of where we are standing. You can't save in an office that is hot. You can't save in a well-ventilated theater. You can't save in the food production or fishery that is not well preserved. It leads to a spoil of product, isn't it? When you are transporting this product, we are shipping products around the world. This point out that with this invisibility of the backbone of modern life, this is where we are standing. Number two, refrigeration and air conditioning is a driver of economic growth and skill development. Refrigeration and air conditioning in industry is not just about equipment, it is an engine of economic growth. Number one, it employs technicians. The industry can confirm. Number two, it demands skills in installation, maintenance, innovation, and creates sustainable jobs for our youth. We have a number of vocational schools that are training students on this air conditioning and refrigeration trade. Number three, it supports key national sectors. Mr. Zikong was taking note from agriculture, is it? Number one, here we have agriculture, mining, hospitality, health, and manufacturing. You might not see the detail of everything until you get to the site, is it? Until you get into a manufacturing plant that you will not be able to stand in there if it's not well ventilated, is it? That's the key, that is the importance of air conditioning and refrigeration as an economic driver and skill development. Number three,
right, that is Erastus Nepolo from the Heat Ventilation and Aircon, you know, Association. That is, you know, it's a, you can hear the vibrant voice in a young man's voice. But we are trying now to bring, so that Dwight can bring us to speed and just sum up everything on this event. That we are talking about of ozone layer, and of course after that we'll bring Herbert Yao. Dwight?
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yes. You know, take us more into details on the issue of the World Ozone Layer Day celebration. So why is that so important from the economic point of view? And I understand the minister, the keynote speaker was the deputy minister in mine science and energy.
Well, thank you very much, Franz, and good afternoon to the listeners. So, Franz, specifically the particular agreement that you are citing in terms of what was just cited there, in terms of the celebrations for World Ozone Day. In Namibia's context, France, it's about the acknowledgement of protecting, firstly you have to protect obviously the atmosphere of the world. That's now what most of the signing parties, which are all the countries, which is 198 of them, all of them UN members, have obviously agreed to do. The key indicator obviously from this particular discussion is that at the start of this agreement, so we're talking about the early 90s and in the 80s, because the agreement was signed in 1989. That's by most countries. And obviously, as when Namibia got its independence, we obviously, you know, we had to agree to this particular pact, which came into effect after we were an independent country. The main or underlying aim of this particular discussion has been, France, that you've got to protect, firstly, the atmosphere above us, because the atmosphere above us is the single most important thing that's actually keeping us alive from the sun's very harmful direct ultraviolet rays. So if people, you know, had not seen that particular discussion in their science classes, you know, on school, is that our atmospheres actually help to sort of like soften the harshness of the ultraviolet light that is being transmitted or emitted by the sun onto this Earth's surface. And that's obviously, if we didn't have an atmosphere, we would have literally been, you know, not just charcoal, but other particular sort of like, burned items on the surface of the planet. However, the discussion of today that took place at the World Ozone Day celebrations, which was organized by the Ministry of Mines and Energy and Industry, where they also brought on the executive director from the Ministry of Environment, that being Mr. Sikongo Hayambo. They cited specifically what Namibia's role has been in specifically of sticking to our nationally determined contributions. Now, one of the speakers, obviously, that were also present was Mr. Erastus Nepolo from the Heat, Ventilation and Air Conditioning Association. So this obviously applies towards the important machines, storage installations and infrastructure that we don't always pay attention to, but they actually play a key role, because you have to understand, France, that air conditioning plays a role in terms of making office spaces, public spaces, sometimes other particular areas of civilian life and everyday life more hospitable, in terms of that you can actually conduct work under, you know, reasonable conditions, specifically in terms of room temperature and air quality. The second scenario obviously was the importance in terms of how you have high concentrations of people living in concentrated areas like cities, or even in apartment blocks, or even in residential areas of said cities, who tap a lot into various kinds of goods or products like air conditioners, refrigerators, or other particular products that also use the ozone damaging substances. This could be gases which are things that you don't easily see. So in the Montreal contract, or in the Montreal protocol as it is named, there's a specific clause or specific phrase or a specific section of it that aims to regulate chlorofluorocarbons. They are known as the CFCs. If you remember what CFCs were, they were the particular harmful substance found in your spray cans. So we're talking about your deodorant spray cans or in other particular kinds of cosmetic goods. You also had your hydrochlorofluorocarbons, which is known as your HCFCs, and they also played a particular important role in terms of the regulation of these particular things. That comes from the Kigali Amendment, which Namibia also signed in 2019, or Namibia was party to that particular agreement. So in many scenarios, this was based upon the aspect of protecting or reducing your greenhouse gas emissions, ensuring that specific sections, regulations, agencies actually play an active role in said particular regulation when you're trying to reduce said particular greenhouse gas emissions. And ultimately, what does this translate towards in terms of Namibia's own particular contribution towards its nationally determined contributions? So, sort of like in a nutshell, Frans, I could jump down the rabbit hole in terms of all the scientific sides or scenarios of it, but it just particularly cites the significant particular role of protecting the Earth's atmosphere, specifically where we find ourselves, because Namibia and Botswana, according to the UNFCCC, we are already 2 degrees hotter than most parts of the world. So it is ultimately a vital scenario for us to maintain or regulate said particular temperatures on our side.
Yeah, Dwight Links, thank you very much for that, for bringing us up to speed on that, in that regard.
Not a problem, Frank.
Right. All right, that was Dwight Links bringing us to speed in terms of, summing up what happened, what took place at the events. And we continue, and very soon we'll be going for a short break. I think in a minute's time, 2 minutes time, but we need to know that, of course, the atmosphere might not be seen as an economic enabler, but it is. But at the same time, dealing with chlorofluorocarbons or chlorofluorocarbons, those are ozone layer depleting, materials that are very, dangerous to our environment. It's not a cheap thing. It's very expensive for countries that are yet to industrialize, because they will pay higher compared to other countries. But it's something to.
Bargain Hunters, where you saves has slashed price on groceries, treats, fresh fruit and veggies. 2 kilos real good frozen mixed chicken portions, just $89.99. 10 kilos number one maize meal, $99.99. And pay just $12.99 for each of the following. 18 roads baked beans in tomato sauce, 100 grams champion French bologna, 20 U brand rooibos tea bags. Save big at you save.
Something very important to consider for countries that are developing. But yes, we are developing, and like I said, that we also have, labor crisis. And labor crisis is not an economic enabler. It's an economic destabilizer. So, and how do we harness, labor? How do we harness labor stability and make sure that, our labor force is a stable and productive enough, to be able to enhance our economic growth? Because we cannot talk about economic growth when we have a destabilized labor force or a destabilized labor environment. If every now and then there is labor dispute, the labor disputes are very expensive. They cost companies money because you have to pay lawyers to settle disputes that are mostly, in most cases, very minor. So, but how do we stabilize the labor environment and use it as an economic enabler instead of an economic destabilizer? So this is what we are talking about. So we will be joined online by labor expert, that is Herbert Jauch, who is going to take us through that. So we just want to find, because we are going through a lot of stress, and the stress is not just about employees, employers too, because we are dragging them to court, you know, losing a lot of money that was supposed to be, of course, injected in business to grow the business and, in fact, even employ more people. And we were also supposed to be stable enough. All right. Like I said, I'm joined online by Herbert Jauch. He's a labor expert and analyst. Good afternoon, Mr. Herbert.
Good afternoon.
Yes. It seems that in Namibia, we are, instead of using labor force or labor environment as an economic enabler, it seems that it is now becoming kind of like an economic destabilizer, because, you know, every now and then there's labor, you know, labor cases. There are labor cases every now and then. There are labor, a dispute. What can we do to change this? Because we need a productive labor force for us to enhance economic growth.
Yes, and this is actually an issue that has come a long, long, long way. The colonial economy, with its racist prejudice, was built on cheap black labor. And with the achievement of independence, we were so focused on just on the political issue and the political independence that we didn't see a real transformation of that economy. And so the kind of low-skill, cheap-wage economy has persisted until today. And it was verified and confirmed with the recent census, which showed that over half of all employed Namibians earn less than 3,000 Namibia dollars a month. Now, this is absolutely ridiculous, because it doesn't allow people to meet even their basic needs. What went hand in hand is the continued reliance on semi-skilled and unskilled labor, and with very few organizations and employers being willing to invest substantially in skills upgrading, but also to move the economy beyond just being a supplier of raw materials, particularly in the mining sector, towards greater beneficiation, towards greater manufacturing in the country, towards an upskilling of the services delivered in the country. That would go hand in hand with higher skills, but also better wages, higher wages. And this transition has not happened. So we've still got very much the colonial apartheid labor market with all its terrible facets. That is becoming a major burden now if we want to change economic structures and if we want to create jobs that are decent in the sense of paying wages that are what we could call a living wage, that would allow people to make a decent living and be able, through better wages, to also spend on local consumer goods. And that in itself would be a local economic stimulus.
So the earning of $3,000, as you are citing it, is it not because Namibia is not a skilled driven economy?
No, it's not. It's not. It very clearly is the vast majority of employed people in lower skills, what they call semi-skilled workers. So we've not made a transition away from that economy towards one of higher skilled with higher wages, and because that would mean moving away from this extractivism based on mining towards more beneficiation, towards manufacturing goods, towards using local resources for local beneficiation, towards, for example, generating renewable energy, young people skilled in solar technologies, for example, decision has not happened. And this is a very sad indictment 35 years after independence. We should have moved much further in transforming this economy. And the new government administration that we have since March talks a lot more about these issues now. And hopefully, it will not just be talking about them, but making changes that affect such structural transformation of the economy, which didn't happen 35 years before that. And this puts us now in a real, real dilemma, because we see it, for example, that even if young people now have skills and tertiary qualifications, many of them are unemployed as well. And this cannot change until the structure of the Namibian economy changes.
But many people, even, you know, citing the reports from the Institute of Public Policy Research, that are arguing that Namibia is not a knowledge-based economy. Therefore, you will really, and even the type of skills that Namibia has are not relevant to the type of economy that, you know, we want to see. How do we reconcile the two?
No, that's precisely the point. A knowledge-based economy and society would place great emphasis not just on basic education, although that's extremely crucial. The foundation of education needs to be laid thoroughly, and there were statistics circulating a few weeks back on how many Namibians that went to school for 8 or 10 years are still often functionally illiterate and are struggling with basic mathematics and so on. Now, this is the one problem, that our basic education has not reached the quality that is needed. It has been successful in terms of outreach, the number of children at school receiving some form of education. There we saw tremendous improvements over the years. But in terms of providing quality education, in terms of laying a solid foundation for education on which the students then can build in specializing further, in that field, we fail. Now, when people discuss the skills available in the country, one must, of course, wonder why are the skills requirement not articulated very clearly, and then different educational institutions, be it vocational training, be it technical training, be it higher tertiary education level, UNAM, NUST, etc., why then they cannot adjust their programs to accommodate those skills requirements. This is something that we've been discussing since independence, actually, and there was always a complaint by employers that the skills are not available in the country. So for me, what doesn't add up, why were those skills not clearly identified and articulated so that local education institutions can address them? Number two, if employers feel that there are no local institutions available to provide that kind of education that they need, why don't they send staff members and young people with a scholarship to acquire those skills elsewhere in neighboring countries or wherever they might be available, and then return with those skills into the economy as a short-term measure to fill the gap? Skills can be acquired. Humans are able to learn, but what we need to do from the beginning is to lay a solid educational foundation so that young people can then later on in life acquire the specific skills needed for particularly new industries and for this transformation. And this is not rocket science. This is something that can be done.
Yeah, but we have seen the trend in, you know, in the government where people are sent and given scholarships and they go back, they go to study and they come back and they don't come and work for those, you know, departed for those agencies that sent them and create another gap overhaul that continuously, you know, goes unfilled. Is it not a fear that the employers might have, especially in the private sector?
It definitely is. You are right. So there must be a provision, for example, that if you receive such a scholarship, that you're then obliged to work for a certain number of years. It's basically like a contract. The employer says, we will send you for this and this course and educational program, and when you come back, you need to work at least X number of years for the company. If you don't, if you leave, you have to pay back the value, the kind of monetary value of your training or scholarship. And in that sense, it would provide the employer with some guarantee. However, that could still run into problems. And the trick would be to offer enough courses locally so that these particular skills that are needed in the economy now can be provided with a substantial number. So it's not just a handful of people that have them, but a much larger group that then can find jobs in the new emerging economies, and then these skills will be used well. You're quite right. If it's just a few and they are in high demand by several companies, they usually go to the highest bidder, and then some organizations feel, well, we paid for the educational program, and now they leave us and someone else is benefiting. That is a dilemma inherent in the system. But as I said, a contract could at least reduce that risk. And yeah, we cannot postpone building schools in the country. We can't. We need that.
Yeah, but the contract, how consequential will be bridging that contract? Because we need to understand this is now, you know, contract versus my right here. Because somebody will say, I still have a right to choose where I want to work.
Absolutely. But the employer can also likewise argue, or government, look, if we provide the resources to enable you to become a professional, let's say also a health professional, someone sent on a scholarship, then we need your skills to benefit public institutions upon your return. So there must be like a legally binding contract that states that you, let's say you sent for studies for a year or two, and upon return you must work at least 3 years for your employer. If you leave earlier, then you must pay back some of that money owed. That can be stipulated in a legal contract. You're quite right. It's a basic right to choose your employer, so no one can be forced to. But on the other hand, you can't just be so single-minded and so focused on yourself only that you say, well, I take the money from organization A to acquire the skills, and once I come back, I drop them and I go to organization B because they pay me more. There's also then a right for the organization that provides the resources for training that they have some benefit from. And I think that this can be best balanced in terms of a legal contract between the parties. And you mentioned government was one of those who lost badly at it, and I can really not see why, for example, a doctor or nurses that are trained and qualified with public funds can then just go or come back and say, now I work for the private sector because I make more money there, or I work on my own. You must plow back then to the public institutions, and so that the public has some benefit of the education that person receives. And I think that requires a bit of a mindset. We tend to think of skills only for quick personal advancement. But we must also see the bigger picture, particularly in the public sector, but also in some of the private companies that might be willing to send people for further education programs, but then want to also retain them for a period of time and not just lose them upon their return.
Now, let's climb higher, because we are now talking about labor stress. And it seems that, you know, we now look at, you know, young people, and we are not talking about, you know, human capital that sometimes we lose irreversibly, that we can never recover to suicide just because of, you know, maybe financial stress, which is caused into, you know, which comes into, you know, when where black tax, you know, come to play. It seems that, you know, once commits a sin for getting a job in a family, for example, and then they become overburdened. And I know that you have been in the labor environment for a long time. Where do we go from here? It seems that we have reached a climax as far as financial stress is concerned.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've worked in and with the unions for 30 years, and I've seen how it got actually worse over time. And the reason is twofold. Number one is in many workplaces, the increase in wages did not keep up with the increases in the costs of living, particularly items like housing. So workers struggled more and more and more to just really meet absolute basic needs. That was the one factor, that their wages did not keep up with the rises in inflation. What economists call the real wage, what you can actually buy, the wages, reduced substantially over the years. This increased the pressure on those workers concerned, because in most households in Namibia, there are just one or two income earners, and the rest of the household, which can be four, six, or even more other people dependent on these two, one or two income earners. The pressure on those income earners increased all the time. More and more items had to be covered, more and more people had to be secured. And that overall crisis got much worse with the rising levels of unemployment. The census data show that 54% of Namibians are unemployed today, because it's not just those who still actively seek work, those who go around looking for jobs. It's also those who are unemployed for long periods of time, who've given up, who sit at home and who've given up hope for finding a job. When we add those two groups together, it's 54%, more than half of the Namibian population. And as I mentioned at the beginning, amongst those who still have some job, over half earn less than 3,000 Namibia dollars a month. Now, you can imagine what these figures in real life, how the small wages that people earn have to be spread amongst whole households, amongst different needs, from clothing to school items to transport to housing, and the wages just can't make ends meet. That puts enormous pressure on the income earners, also in terms of mental stress, just worrying all the time that you have to live with insufficient funds. But it also puts enormous pressure on, for example, young people in households that have finished their schooling and can't find paid work. They can't find a job. And then they wonder, well, what's the point? What am I contributing? And that again puts a lot of mental stress on young people as well. Their self-worth is affected. Their families look at them and say, now, why don't you contribute and go out and find work when there is no work? And even starting your own business is tricky. You might maybe find some resources to start, but when you are in an impoverished community where people don't have spending money, the chances of your small business are very low, and it might collapse, and then you're back to square one. So all these developments around our labor market affect families very deeply in both physical stress and mental stress. And it's a very unhealthy environment to live in, when you forever have to worry how you're going to go to make it through the next day.
Hey, but it seems that in Namibia, we have demonized, you know, the employing sector. I mean, the employing arm of the economy, especially in the private sector, where, you know, companies, you know, employers are demonized to be the source of the reason why there's so much financial stress, when they themselves are not in control of what is going on economically, because much of the economic pressure is external.
Well, it's a bit of both. You know, when when you look at some companies and some also publish their profits, and then you hear that some organizations increase their profitability by 12%, for example. But then employees at the very same company, they get an increase of 3 to 4%. Now, and I don't think that's demonization in any way. It's just to remind them, look, your increases in profitability came about because of the people that work at this company.
Yeah.
And you want to keep such a large chunk of profitability for yourself without sharing it in any way fairly with the people who work for your employees. Now, such employers, in my view, must be called to order. With others that struggle themselves, and you're quite right, there is no one type of employer across the country. And some companies do very well, others do not. In such cases, the employer should be open and open the books and share it with workers to look at the dilemma. I was once witnessing in Walvis Bay, our company said, well, our income is reduced. We need to fire 54 workers. There's no way around that. And then after some discussions, they were willing to open the books to show where the expenditure went, and they negotiated with the workers, the shop stewards of the union. And after about 3 months of discussions and negotiations, they found a way to maintain and to save all those 54 jobs. And that is possible if there's an openness to discuss issues with workers at different places and to then find possible solutions. So I don't think it's actually a question of demonizing. But some employers that want to keep the profitability just for their own benefits and not share it with the people who made those profits possible, they, of course, need to be reminded and called to order. And secondly, with companies that struggle, my advice would be far more open, share it with workers, discuss openly what are possible solutions, and then I think also in terms of settling possible disputes, if there is such openness, the chance of finding a solution is much higher. But of course, when employers want to hide essential information about the company and always tell workers that there is no money, then why should workers believe it? It requires the opening of books. It requires transparency for workers to believe such a story. Otherwise, of course, they will rightly think, well, the employer doesn't want to share the book because they are hiding some of their profits from us so that they can keep our kind of wage increases. And these are some of the trends that I've seen over the years in the Namibian labor market. And that is also one of the causes why there's so much tension at several workplaces.
Wow. Herbert Liao, let me thank you for your time, and thank you very much for that insightful, commentaries that you have given us as far as the labor environment is concerned in Namibia.
Thank you very much, Franz, for the invitation, and have a good day.
Right, that was, of course, Herbert Yahu here, giving a very balanced, approach to things here, to things there. That, of course, for those companies that are making profit, you need to look at your enablers. Your workforce is your enablers. Those are the enablers for a profit. But there are companies that are very struggling, and we cannot put them in the same basket with those that are making it, to force them to do what they are not able to do. When some of the companies were even under very much stress during COVID-19, and they did not even lay off their workers. So I think there are commendable, situations, and they are regrettable, of course, situations as far as the labor is concerned. But this is the one that is bringing a lot of stress in many Namibians. When you earn so little and they're expected to spend so much. But of course, the number in studio 0832-8401, wherever you are listening us to, wherever you are listening us from, it's on the radar analysis with Francis Nengera. Of course, you don't expect to hear news with me because I'm not a news person. I'm an analyst. I'm an analytical person. I turn news into discussion. I'm not going to come in here and tell you what happened, where, when, why. I'm coming to tell you why it is happening. Why do we have problems? Why do we have labor, you know, stress? Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Tame na kombinga kuyo kombuwa ku koina kuroma pia ndio igereze ni ati utwali kwa mitengo kitaisha gani ngahamana anomo nga irimombe po
ya mai irimombe po to para que na komarungura pongata tuya
o ya iku kina wali kwa radio
ya ae topi kine manga komarungura kwa radio pongata tuya
o kupitile keke ngodi mbo mbodi
ee
Okay, what's your name? France, huh?
Yeah, sure now.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. All right, if you want to listen to us, please just download the app for now. Just download the application for now. But, yeah, our discussion is why do we have so much labor acts? You know, so much financial stress. You get your pay, and by the third, your money is already finished. And then, your money is finished even before it comes. Because you receive a lot of SMSs from whoever you are. You are the only two people that are working in a family of 11, and 9 of you are not working. So, you alternate between A and B, sending message to this one, and it's a sin in a black community to say, I don't have. And because it is a sin in a black community to say you don't have, you want to act as if you have. And you squander, I mean, you earn 10,000, but you want to live a 30,000, you want to live a life of somebody that earns 30,000 per month. Even the people that earn 30,000 per month don't live such a high, you know, they don't live such a high life that you want to live. And in that case, you will be an activist in the company. Because you want to use the company as a collateral for your own financial mismanagement. Sometimes it's like that. So in as much as, of course, we know it's very important to increase the salaries of people and for companies, but it's also important for us who are employees and some of us who are salary earners to also live within our means. You know, we should also learn to live within our means. That's also very important because we are living in a money world. Where it seems that money is the one that is defining everything now and deciding everything. But there is also a problem that we also have what we call black tax. That will never forgive you until you pay tax. And the black tax is forever. You pay it until you die. And it's a sin to say you don't have. And also peer pressure where you see a friend driving a car. You don't even know how that car came about, and you are also forced to buy a car. You see your friend with iPhone, you know, 16 or 17. You don't even know how it came about. You are also forced. So, colleague pressure, what I call colleague pressure, it also exists. It's not just like peer pressure. You know, some people will be eating burgers every day, like at work on lunchtime. They'll be eating pizza every day. Well, they will go wherever they will go to every time it's chicken and this, but you can't afford it. Why don't you just cook pap and come with a lunchbox and eat your pap with whatever it is that you are using, pap and milk. That's what you can afford. So sometimes it's colleague pressure and peer pressure that at the end of the day ends up, you know, eating us inside. We are being eaten up. And sometimes it's family pressure where your mother and your father expect how much money per month. And if you give mom money, dad also needs the same amount that you gave to mom. So you can't say, okay, mom, let me rest this month because last month I gave you 4,000. Let me rest. You know, saying that you will hear some threats that will make you even go to cash loan immediately and, you know, borrow the money and then you send the money. So which means we are living for others and we are not living for ourselves. So at the end of the day, you are overwhelmed because work is demanding. You start losing the taste of the very work itself that you look for. You start losing the taste of the very job, you know, itself that you so much wanted after graduating. And now you are losing taste of it because of family pressure. There are a lot of pots cooking against you in the background. Family pressure, you have mom and dad allowance, then sibling allowance, then girlfriend allowance, especially for men. And that is already a microwave. You have already put your head on a microwave. So very soon you will be deceased because that, if it is not going to culminate into a high blood pressure and chronic heart issues, it's suicide. So because we are refusing to live, we are refusing to say no. We don't know how to say no, and then we don't know, we want to live for others, we want to please others, and of course, be seen as generous. Generosity does not mean financial stupidity. Generosity does not mean financial indiscipline. Generosity does not mean financial, you know, does not mean you must squander or spread money everywhere. You don't have the money. So, these are, and then we become very bitter at work. And what will happen is that we become then, we don't even have negotiation anymore. We want to close the companies. The company must increase us or close down. You know, because we are going through so much pressure in ourselves and we want a messiah. So that's, of course, that's the issue that is, you know, bringing us down. And in America, people have gone to the point where they have a credit card for food, just to buy food, because people are no longer affording to buy food. They have now credit card for food. It has not yet come to Namibia where you have a card for food in stores, like you pay on credit. You buy food on credit. We don't have that yet. But in America, people have that because, you know, it has come to that point. But how many billions America is spending in wars, in supporting Israel and Gaza chaos and Ukraine and Russia chaos? Hundreds of millions of billions that are supposed to, you know, help ease the burden on an average American citizen. So, and of course, Yao said that, look, our labor force mentality is a colonial racist mentality of cheap labor. But then there's a problem because there are companies that are saying that they put their people on in a scholarship. You go to Turkey, you go to Russia, and when you come back, you are supposed to come and work for us for this period of time. But some people, when they go, they come back and they look for jobs somewhere else. But I think for private companies, it is easy because they put up stringent conditions. But for government, they only send you and they keep quiet. When you come back from there, you just maybe work for 3 months while you are looking for a better job. As soon as you get a better job, you are gone. And then the government struggles again to find similar scholarship for somebody else that comes back and does the same, and then the cycle continues. So this is the issue. So we are going through financial stress, we are going through labor stress, because our economy is not a knowledge-based economy. It's not, our country is not knowledge-based. It's not knowledge-driven. So our country is not knowledge-driven. That's why we will go back, we will continue to end below 3,000. Because if you say you want 5,000, you want 5,000 for what? When your skill level is not to that level. So somebody would argue that, no, I will not pay 5,000 for you because you cannot do ABCD. You cannot do ABCD. So our skills level are also speaking to the reason why we are not where we are supposed to be. 0832888401. That's the number in studio. What do you think we can do to ease this pressure? What do you think we can do to ease this financial, pressure or labor issue? Because it's financial pressure that brings labor crisis. It's labor crisis that destabilizes the economy. So these three, when they are solved, when we have financial literacy, and we'll become more productive. And, maybe we'll have a stable labor environment. When people are earning better wages, they will have a stable labor environment. And that will then mean, even if we say, okay, let's now pay everyone 15,000. It seems that we get confused by numbers. So if somebody said, okay, your salary will be 25,000. You have created a scenario where this person will live a life value of 75,000, of a person that earns 75,000 when he just get paid. Where you just get paid 25,000. Because this person will start dreaming big, because we are deceived by numbers. And also because we did not grow up in an environment of money. So we were not taught from a young age to understand money. We just came to see money when we are working, at graduation, or maybe, as a student, when you get your refund, your NSFAF refund. You see, even the way a student will behave when they get their NSFAF refund, that they will not even tell the parents that they got a refund. You will only come to know it when they are sad there, when you see behaviors, that's when you come to know that they are scammed. That's when they will sit down and want to talk, because now they have lost the money. Did you get the money? Yes. It's just a number. Get 17,000. That 17,000 confuses a person. Because we did not grow up with money. We don't know money. So the number 17 is big enough to keep your brain, you know, busy, that will not sleep. If it is possible, you even want to go and sleep in the bank. So, and that same behavior we get when we start working. We get blinded by the number. And only when we start, only when things start to go wrong. And even our parents, they also become confused by numbers. Just to hear that you are getting 30,000. Mom would want her 10,000 just for her. So, without necessarily considering where is this person working, how is this person getting to work? No, mom would want, I want 15,000 next month. This is what, because we just wake up and decide. Just look at the way you ask money from your parents or from your sister, who is working, or your brother. It shows you that you don't know money. You know? And just look at your SMS. I want 2,000 or I want 500. Look at your message. It shows that we were not trained to understand money. And because we were not exposed to money, by the time we come to get to see money, it becomes a problem. And this is what takes us down. Because we start squandering money, and then at the end of the day, we are so much under pressure. Because number one, we ourselves don't understand money. The people that we are trying to help also don't understand. And then it becomes a problem. So, you can't have a 200 and want to live like somebody that has a 2,000. And the problem also is how we are exaggerated, our needs are exaggerated. Because advertisement companies will tell you, you cannot live without an iPhone 14. When you don't have an iPhone, you are not digitized yet until you have an iPhone. There are a lot of digital devices that you can afford. If you can't afford an iPhone, buy an iPhone, a Samsung A05. That's what you can afford. Till such a time when you can afford. And you know what? iPhone is here forever. If you want to stress because of it, you will die and leave it behind. And in fact, the day you die is the day they release a new model. So let's learn to calm down and live within the means of what we are able to afford. So it's those are, because we are the economic enablers. And we are the labor force. We are the workers. We are the workforce. We are the first enablers to economic growth. But now we are dying and leaving a gap, very big gap. Sometimes it's not even filled. Or it's the skills that we had, maybe it will take time again for somebody like us to appear. And that's an economic setback. Because we are killing ourselves and we are being killed because we don't understand money. So the number is a one. You know, once you get, you sit in the office with your boss, and your boss tells you, you are going to, your salary will be 25,000. If you are living in Havana, something tells you already that, look at your pay slip. Windhoek North, or in the Windhoek West. Because we don't know what is economical. We run for opportunity costs. And we don't know what is economical. So if you are living in Achonise, by the time you start to say, your boss tells you your salary is 25,000, you want to say, Achonise is too far. I want to move close to town. But do you know how much rent is close to town? You know, do you know how much is rent close to town? And do you also know that there are many people in Achonise that are earning higher than you? So, but we get confused by numbers and we start making wrong decisions that take us down, and then we start being unproductive at work, because then we start to accuse the company that, no, the salary that we are earning are too small. The salary can no longer sustain me. The salary can no longer sustain me, but it's just because of the confusion from the number, and we made wrong decisions. It is 17 minutes past the hour of 2 o'clock, and by 2:30 I'll be out of here. If you want to be part of the conversation, you want to engage on this very topic of discussion for today on this on the radar. Of course, we had Herbert Yao. We also had Dwight links with a presentation at Ozone Lair, the importance of, you know, taking care of the of Ozone Lair. You can still come through. The number is 2032884 01. That's the number, and of course it's lunch hour. People are coming back from lunch. And I told you that sometimes, and since we are economic enablers, we also need to take care of ourselves. We need to take care of ourselves. You know, colleague pressure. Somebody bought pizza and you want pizza, but you can't afford pizza. Or some people are coming with burgers every day. They are eating ribs, you know, pork ribs every day, or whatever it is that they are eating, and you also want. But you don't know the source of their income. Maybe they have side hustles. So when somebody wants to buy a polo, latest polo, you also want. But you don't even, you do not even make an investment. You see? So maybe this person had like a policy that they has matured, or maybe the person has inherited the money, or maybe the mother retired, this pensions from the mother or from the parents. You don't know the source of the incomes of the people you want to imitate. So we need financial discipline so that we are able to work, to be a proper workforce. Because the financial indiscipline will make us a very bitter workforce. You know, and it will create toxic environment in companies, because we become very angry, and then we become very incompetent and very unproductive. But we are also the contributing factors. Maybe the wages are small. I mean, the wages are little. Maybe wages are not enough. But what if we are also major contributing factors to what we are going through? Because maybe we don't know, maybe we did not make correct decisions, maybe we did not make right decisions with our money. Maybe you were too quick to move out of the rent where you were. It was cheap. There are people who say, okay, look, I'm growing up now, I want to start buying property, I want to start buying stuff, but the room that I'm living was just a small room, maybe for 1.8, it was just a bed and something. So since I got the increment, let me look for something better, so I can buy, you know, furniture and, yeah. So those are good considerations. But let's look for places we can afford. And let's not be blinded by the number. You know, if you are earning 3,000 and you hear a boss tell you, no, we are increasing you to 9,000, doubling your increment, or you'll be 9,000. You live the life of a 3,000. So this is the psychology that money plays. For the first month, you are getting that 9,000. Wow. The 9,000 really is making a difference. But 2 months, 2-3 months later, you start to feel that, this 9,000 is peanut. I want more. You start wanting more. So that's the psychological, you know, part of numbers. Because numbers are big. Numbers becomes big at intervals. You know, at the first interval, the number is really big. 12 is big. But as we go, you start to find out that 12 is small. Because you start to accumulate more things that you think you can afford. And then at the end of the day, leading yourself into problem.
Hello?
Yes.
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
How are you?
Good.
Good. Yes, yeah, there are some elements that are also being overlooked in terms of collective bargaining power. Issues, and like it's true, you know, you said correctly that sometimes our limited knowledge to analyze those budgets, the organizational budget, especially in the tailor and all these industries, limit us to really bargain fairly, I mean in good faith. So that's why if we cannot analyze the budget for the company and see to it whether they are making profit or lose, then obviously the workers will be on the receiving end. Because one, the figures might be manipulated by those who are there, maybe qualified expertise. But then when it comes to the negotiation of the salary and wages and salary, and all other working conditions, so our people, the way I'm observing, that they don't really look at into the budget of those organizations. And when we bargain, the people who I have seen a lot of activities going on and things like that, they don't really look at other benefits, or maybe fringe benefits, for example, if it can be applicable. But they just look at the salary. And the salary sometimes become big. And then these are the social conditions, issues that are not, the social are not addressed. So in the bargaining box there is a need for serious skill development so that the workers now, the representatives, the tours and things like that. And people should follow the process of bargaining. Because if we don't follow the right procedure, they do not look at the other side then people will end up losing the job, and then at the same time, they will not even get any benefit, either an increase in a medical benefit or whatever. Those are some of the areas where I believe the expertise also need to address. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Uncle Bana.
Good.
Yes. All right. So we continue. 083-238-401. What are your views? What are your views? Very soon I'll be out of here. In fact, I only have 4 minutes to get out of here. In 4 minutes time, but I can still give you more time if you want to be part of the conversation. If I can give you, when I say I can give you more time, I can give you the 4 minutes to, yeah, so those are the stuff that we need to understand, that we are responsible, you know, of what we make, decisions that we make based on the how much the amount of money that we want, that we have. We start to live, you know, fancy lives, because now you are working and we have a lot of accounts and you have a lot of aunties and uncles that, you know, are calling you, a lot of cousins, a lot of brothers, sisters. When you are working, you know, when you start to work, everybody depends on you. And funerals, weddings, it's on you. Everything is on you. So, because we are not allowed to recoup under black tax, because black tax is regulated directly by individuals, it's not by government. We are not even deducted by NAMRA. There is another NAMRA that is FAMLA. FAMLA, a Family Revenue Agency. So NAMRA does not apply, it is FAMRA, which is a Family Revenue Agency. And that one has no regulatory order. It fluctuates. You are at the mercy of the tax invoice. That is what is, you know, making the labor environment, filling it with much fire. People become stressed, and the stress does not entirely come from companies. The stress also comes as a result of families that don't understand what being employed is, because maybe you are the only person that is working in the family, so people don't understand what spending is. They think that because you are working in Windhoek, you have money, or because you are working, you have money. So the thinking is very different. Alright, so this has been the On the Radar. We are going to meet again tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay tuned for, of course, stay tuned for Onkundana Vingi, that is, of course, coming shortly. So it's coming shortly, just stay tuned, and very soon Onkundana Dingi will come.
And LinkedIn, our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the R.
Omutiha kutekirwa kaguna ii matina omjo. Chikawa shafaa sana na nongeshifaa ya ishiwike moshiwana. Iye moya o, ota ingongotisa mwene. Anangeshifaa ya Namibia, ombitombwa na wa oronjika. Seisa nina omayakuro ni randitoma yoe, yongeshifaa yoe kupitira mo Eagle FM Media House. Ngoe tuende tuimemeha uka kombanga nena. Kara omkwashi pareki uimwepo yomo programa detu. Moambo, dengira selma, onora heta tuimwe. Datundatu, heari hamano tano, oniaj. Eagle FM, the eye.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the eye.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Omutiha kutekirwa kaguna ii matina omjo. Chikawa shafaa sana na nongeshifaa ya ishiwike moshiwana. Iye moya o, ota ingongotisa mwene. Anangeshifaa ya Namibia, ombitombwa na wa.